Radio Influence, podcasting redefined.
Daniel, UFC 249 took place last weekend. We're here to recap it here on this edition of the MMA Report podcast. Also, we're going to continue our countdown of the top 100 fighters, plus get everyone ready for this week's MMA. And, you know, Daniel, obviously a lot of things have happened, you know, since the last time we did a show. Of course, last time we did a show, we were previewing UFC 249. And, you know, after the fights were over, you know, I tweeted this, Daniel, that, you know, look, obviously the UFC had its critics in doing this event, especially after the Jacare news came out. But the UFC, I really feel that on Saturday night, they put a blueprint on how to do an event with no fans for it to look great on television. Because I think that if you would have taken the sound off watching that event on Saturday, I don't know if you would have realized that there are actually no fans in attendance, because I thought the UFC production team did a fabulous job of presenting just a great product on television.
Yeah, it really was a great show and a great return to sports. I think a lot of people who had apprehension for sporting events without fans as a television product watched this pay-per-view and thought, maybe my opinion isn't incorrect. Sports without fans might not be that big of a downgrade, is I think what a lot of people thought, and maybe those with the hotter takes even said it's even better without fans, which is not the case. My example would be the Vicente Luque versus Nico Price fight, which was an absolute banger. I really do think would have been more enjoyable with fans. On the flip side, the Tony Ferguson Justin Gaethje fight actually was pretty dang, like, intoxicating. You could not keep your eyes off that fight because of the brutality of it, of Justin Gaethje's offensive strikes landing, and occasionally, whether it be the uppercut or whatnot, Tony fighting back. The sound of the empty arena, and you get the sense of the brutality and the intimacy within the cage, you're like, damn, this is brutal as hell. So in some instances, it was kind of superior, but overall, it was a very positive night for the promotion. And overall, it was a really well-done production from the UFC side. I mean, to me, the only two notes and tidbits I would have on the production would be, one, in the main event, when Bruce Buffer's like, it's time, they didn't have a shot at Bruce Buffer. They had like a wide shot of like the cage and everything. And I would have preferred a camera on Bruce Buffer when he does the it's time for the first time in literally like months. And the second thing was, I really didn't like the camera shot they would go to where they would start off with like the concrete floor and they would kind of pan up to the cage. Those shots to me were the only shots in the broadcast that really reminded you of how empty the arena was. I think if you refrain from using those and instead use shots from up above, I think those are better. But overall, it was a spectacular production given the circumstances. I think those behind the scenes should be proud of what they put on pay-per-view.
Yeah, man, it was an enjoyable night of fights. And yesterday, the Sports Business Journal comes out reporting that, you know, did a little north of 700,000 pay-per-view buys, which I think that's an amazing number. Look, going into this, if you would have told me the number was 700,000, I don't know whether or not I would have believed it. I mean, and the prelims, you know, television number came out, you know, I want to say it was 1.154 million, which is a great number. I mean, you know, I think that there was obviously a lot of fans tuning in. And at the end of the day, you know, look, and we can talk about the, you know, the various negative aspects that came out of this fight card, but, you know, there's a lot of positive things. And I think the biggest positive to come out of this was, A, it was great to have live sports. It was just so fun for me to sit on the couch and just sit back and watch fights and sit on social media and interact with fans during the broadcast with what was going on. And of course, at the end of the day, the fights delivered. It was, you know, all the outside of like, if I was, there was one point where I think I saw a tweet that said, are Carlos Esparza and Michelle Waterson practicing social distancing during their fight?
I know. And then even Greg Hardy and Jair Rosenstruck got in on the action. With that they were safe, Esparza and Waterson. I appreciated that, you know, their social distancing. But yeah, that fight was kind of That was one of those where I was watching it and I just kind of glazed over at times. And I just had, I had no opinion on the judge's decision there.
Yeah, I mean, it was, there was times that fight, I was like, just looking at Carla's game plan that fight, I'm like, man, what was exactly the game plan, of course? And then the weird thing is you heard Carla talk about it, Vicente Luque talked about it, Greg Hardy talked about it, the fact of being able to hear the commentary, how that kind of affected things, which, you know, I can tell you, as someone who's done MMA commentary, I'll never, the couple times I've done it, the one thing that always stuck out to me was when the action was right in front of you. And in my mind, I'm going, okay, Jason, make sure you're watching what you say here. You know, you don't want to piss somebody off here. But, I mean, look, overall, it was a great night of fights. And, you know, one of the things about the main event in Justin Gaethje, the fact that he landed 72% of his strikes is just insane. And, you know, look, one of the questions about Justin Gaethje, and it's been this question for, is particularly in the UFC, is what happens if the fight hits the championship rounds. He answered all those doubters right there. Just an amazing performance by Justin Gaethje. I think that, you know, the fight we all wanted to see was Khabib versus Tony. And I feel like at this point, Daniel, we got maybe a 30% chance that fight ever happening.
I would say, like, well, gosh, that's a tough one to answer. Because the question is this. Will Tony Ferguson return to form? And I don't know, because he is up there in age. He's fought for a very long time. This is such a brutal sport. And I think a 30% might be right where it's at, Jason. Because obviously, if given the opportunity, the UFC will put these two together in the cage. Even with the loss, Ferguson and Nurmagomedov is the fight we've thought about for such a long time that if either of these guys are in the realm of it making sense, you know they're going to try and book it one more time. Just because there's a real chemistry with that matchup. That's a matchup you could put on a fight night. Let's say Nurmagomedov loses to Justin Gaethje. Nurmagomedov versus Tony Ferguson to me is still a marketable fight you can put on top. Maybe not a pay-per-view anymore if he loses his luster. But if either those guys find themselves in a similar realm, I think the UFC will book it just because we've invested so much thought looking towards it. In terms of like a lightweight championship contest, I do think that's unlikely. It's crazy to think about how dramatically different we are looking at Tony Ferguson before Saturday versus after. Before, he was a heavy favorite against Justin Gaethje. It was a matter of not if, but when he fights Khabib for the title. Tony was a pretty solid favorite against Gaethje. And with one performance, Justin Gaethje completely changed the landscape of the lightweight division. He was a clear-cut contender. I think if you told a lot of people that Justin Gaethje beat Ferguson on Saturday night, the idea would probably be, okay, let's run back a rematch. But it was such a dominant beatdown on Tony Ferguson. Obviously, that is without the question. So for Tony, it's all about rebounding. The question is if he's able to, and I don't know if his body is going to let him, Jason, because this was not a fight that was close. This was a fight where Justin Gaethje literally beat the ever-living hell out of Tony Ferguson. Tony Ferguson took so many shots that would have knocked out so many guys in this lightweight division. He did not flinch. He's a tough SOB, but being tough comes at the cost of kind of depleting yourself. So, if I had to tell you, I don't think we see Tony Khabib, Jason, just because I think Tony Ferguson, El Kakui, the boogeyman's best days are behind him.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those fights that you just kind of wonder, are we ever going to see Tony kind of, you know, be the Tony Ferguson we've seen? I mean, you know, he's 36 years old. You know, obviously, you know, especially at 155 pounds, that age is high. You know, when you look at the elite of that division, you know, typically late 20s, early 30s, you know, so you never know whether Tony's going to recover from that. But, you know, who knows? Maybe he does, you know, and kind of how the UFC goes with that. And look, I, you know, from a fight aspect, I'm all in on Khabib versus Justin. I mean, that to me is a great fight. I mean, obviously we know about the wrestling pedigree that Justin Gaethje has, and more uses it to stop takedown offense as opposed to being an offensive wrestler. But I mean, look, you mentioned about those shots. I mean, there was, you know, 15, 20 shots that Justin landed that fight that probably stop a majority of the lightweight division, which makes you go, man, what if he's able to keep the fight on the feet and he's able to land those strikes against Khabib? You know, could he finish the fight? But, you know, of course, Conor McGregor is very good at keeping himself in the news cycle. And Daniel, that was yesterday, as it was a series of tweets that Conor McGregor did send out, directed at various people. He directed one at Tony Ferguson. He directed one at Gaethje, one at Khabib, one at Dustin Poirier. He does an excellent job of keeping his name in the news cycle. And then he says, "See you in July." And I know Dana was asked about this. I'm not sure if it was before the event or after the event, where he basically said, you know, hey, it's kind of tough to do a Conor fight with no fans, because obviously the amount of money that Conor brings in. And then, you know, I see Ali Abdelaziz, the manager of Justin Gaethje and Khabib Nurmagomedov, you know, noting that, no, that's the fight that's going to happen. And Conor could be the co-main event, which is just goddamn comical to think that you think the biggest star in the sport is going to be a co-main event for your two fighters, and they can maximize on those pay-per-view points. Yeah, get out of here with that nonsense. But you know, man, if you say what fight would I rather see, Conor versus Gaethje or Gaethje versus Khabib? God, I'd probably say Gaethje versus Conor.
Well, it's definitely the same mindset we had when we asked ourselves the question of whether or not we would want to see Gaethje Ferguson versus Gaethje Khabib, just because, like, a Khabib Gaethje fight, I think we know, plays out one of two ways. One way is a lot more exciting than the other, which is a stand-up affair, in that Khabib will not be able to take down Gaethje, but the more likely outcome is a wrestle fest, which is a bit more or less appetizing than what the idea would be of a striking clash between Conor and Justin. I mean, in that aspect, you'd have two of the most exciting strikers in the UFC. I think Justin Gaethje at this point is the most exciting non-heavyweight striker. I would say the most exciting striker in the entire promotion has to be Francis Ngannou right now. But in terms of non-heavyweights, I would say Gaethje's number one. And then McGregor's pretty high up there too, just because it all goes back to the series of knockouts he's put together. So definitely that's the fight. But obviously you have Gaethje and Nurmagomedov. I mean, they're managed by the same guy. Those two guys are going to fight each other. It's all said and done. It would be interesting if like one guy leaves him just so they get the best part of the deal. I feel like that's something I would do. Like I wonder how often managers manage how often does that happen, Jason, that you have a championship fight where a manager manages both guys? Is that a common thing? And if so, like, what are the pros and cons of you having that happen, especially if you're like Justin Gaethje, where you're the B side of the equation?
Last time I recall that happening would be Henry Cejudo versus Marlon Moraes last year. They're both represented by Ali. I mean, look, I think if I'm in the Justin Gaethje camp, I think that you have to sit there and say, okay, look, you have to understand that Khabib is Ali's biggest client. I don't think anyone would doubt that. I think if you're Justin, I think you got to sit there and have that conversation with yourself of, is Ali going to be able to get you the most money, or could there be another manager that does not have a business relationship with Khabib that maybe he can get more money? I mean, that I think that's only a question that Justin Gaethje has to ask himself.
Yeah, I think he will ask that question, but I think that, like, he's probably going to stay business as usual, especially during these times. I mean, you mentioned the economic situation in terms of there's just going to be no attendance, no gate for a Khabib Gaethje fight. And then obviously you shared with me a tweet that the estimate was, what, 700,000 buys for this pay-per-view?
Yes.
So, I mean, that's a lot of money. And I think Gaethje Nurmagomedov will do very similar. I think the next Conor fight will definitely do over a million. But I do think you might have some motivation to really ensure that you are in the best possible position. But I think when you're with someone for such a long time, they probably have a good good control over you, and you'll kind of go with the flow there. So yeah, it'll be an Ali Abdelaziz main event, and I'm assuming that's going to happen on Fight Island. I mean, for Conor, I would like to see him fight Tony Ferguson. Like for Tony, like, I do want to mention, like, it was such an admirable performance that he put together, and he's had one hell of a career. And it just shows you how brutal this sport is, where it's like the dude is on top of the world, and in just one fight, it feels like he's aged so much. And that initial observation could be dramatically wrong. This guy has showcased an amazing mental fortitude. He could absolutely rebound and return to form. That would not be shocking at all. But we've seen time and again in this sport, things change quickly and dramatically. And from upon first glance, this is the type of performance where you're like, it's on the downhill now for Tony. But that could certainly be wrong. Still, he still is a very viable name. I think anyone who watched that fight came away being a big fan of Tony Ferguson, and I think the fight that makes sense has to be Tony versus Conor. I mean, there's a couple other options out there, but I think that's also a solid matchup for Conor McGregor too. It's a nice combination of what type of style he has and also the name value.
Yeah, when you talk about Conor McGregor, there's just so many matchups that interest you. I mean, look, you can, you know, him and Nate Diaz were going back and forth on IG. There's the thought of him versus Jorge Masvidal. You know, maybe you look at the rematch against Dustin Poirier. You look at a fight against Tony Ferguson. I mean, this is the one thing. There is plenty of matchups there for Conor McGregor. You know, by the way, speaking of tweets, and because of this love-hate relationship that Dana White has with the media currently, I was surprised to see how many media tweets ended up on the broadcast, including myself. I did not even see it live. My wife is actually the one who saw it. I was looking down the computer screen at the end of the Henry Cejudo Dominic Cruz fight, so it was kind of interesting to see all the various tweets out there. But if we would have said last week that someone is going to announce their retirement, Henry Cejudo or Dominic Cruz, I don't think there's any way we would have likely picked Henry Cejudo, even though he has mentioned this in the past. And Daniel, we've been down this road about combat sports athletes in retirement. I'm not buying it. I hear what Henry Cejudo is saying. I understand where he is coming from. But to me, listening to his comments, and particularly in the post-fight press conference, it's very clear to me, write enough zeros on that check and I'll fight.
Yeah, yeah. I think whenever a guy retires and he's already talking about maybe coming back if the money's there, you know the retirement will be short-lived. It's interesting. Like, you're happy for him. He went out on top, but overall, it's like, this dude is coming back, is my general takeaway. He's already talking about coming back. He's been a competitor and an athlete his entire life. And sometimes, as you've seen with, you know, Michael Jordan, for instance, when you compete every single day, you do get burnt out and you're like, let me escape. He's already done that once with the wrestling, and it's possible he's doing this with mixed martial arts, where he's just like, I'm unplugged. I'm not willing to plug it back in. It'll be interesting to see when he gets back in the gym, if he ever does. But Henry is a very unique individual. It wouldn't be surprising if he very easily changes lanes and starts doing something else. He really put together a nice legacy for himself. He's definitely not in consideration for, like, greatest fighter of all time or anything like that, just because his success in the UFC was so limited. There's only a few championship-level victories, and when you contrast him with hell, a guy he beat, Demetrius Johnson, St-Pierre, Silva, and John Jones, he falls short, and that's not because he's a flyweight. So I do think Henry showcased real great upside to, like, his best performances. He looked like the best fighter on the planet. So I think the one thing he's leaving on the table is the legacy of being the best fighter of all time. It was maybe unlikely that he achieved that, but he certainly had the opportunity to do so. It probably would have taken 3 to 6 more championship defenses to be put in that type of consideration. So that's what he's leaving on the table in addition to the money. But this is a very brutal sport, and to go out on top is an admirable thing for him to do. But I'm sure everyone there was stunned. I think the UFC was really thinking they were going to be able to build around Henry Cejudo for the next 1 to 2 years. He was one of the few lighter weight fighters that was really starting to establish himself as a star. So, boom, you just have one of your stars gone.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things about Henry was, I mean, just looking at the fight of to have the accidental clash of heads that causes that massive cut, and then just a beautifully timed knee that he was, you know, laid there and dropped to Dominic Cruz, and what was it, land 10 or 11 unanswered strikes before Keith Peterson called in to stop the fight. You know, when I watched it live, my first initial thought was, man, is that an early stoppage? Because you kind of saw Dom getting up, even though I wouldn't say he was defending the strikes. Now, when you go back and you watch the replay, I sit there and go, you know what? I really got no problem with the stoppage. And actually, the tweet that made on the broadcast, I just wrote early stoppage ? But, you know, after the fight was over, Dominic Cruz made a lot of suggestions or accusations, I would say, about Keith Peterson and noting that he smelled of alcohol and cigarettes. Here's my question about that, Daniel. If you smell of cigarettes, what's the big deal with that?
Yeah, I was also defending that too. It's like there's nothing wrong with smoking a cigarette before a fight. There, all right. That's hey man, you taking the edge off. It's not like it's affecting your mental capacity. You know, hell, back in the day, like the 90s, dudes are smoking cigarettes at the halftime at NBA game. You know, so it's just like, you know, hey, quit hating on the cigarettes, Dom Cruz. I'm sorry we all can't be perfect and whatnot, but, you know, alcohol consumption would be rough. But overall, I think everyone in the MMA community took that criticism and threw it in the dumpster where it belongs. Look, if a dude is drinking before he's refereeing, that's a major problem. But I think that's something that nobody believes for a second, given the track record of Keith Peterson. You know, he's someone who referees constantly. Is a big time presence, and there is a scarce amount of things we can think towards, like, oh, he did a bad job that time. So Keith Peterson is a well respected referee, and it's absolutely weak for Dominic Cruz to try and assassinate his character, to allude to the fact that he was a drunk alcoholic in there officiating his fight. You know, it's like, Dom Cruz, here's the thing. You got put on your back, and was it an early stoppage? I do think so. But the moment in which Keith Peterson stopped that fight, Dom Cruz was eating the canvas. His face shifted where he was trying to get up with the headstand, and that in itself was pretty weak. So was the stoppage early? Probably. But Dom Cruz changed the way we were having a conversation about this topic by trying to assassinate Keith Peterson's character.
Yeah, I mean, I have no idea whether his accusations are true or false. Have no clue. If they are false, sore loser is the first thing I would put. And I would never have said that about Dom Cruz, you know, leading into this. I mean, especially when you think about after he lost to Cody Garbrandt and how he stood in front of the media and everything that he said, you know, I think it's one of those things of, you know, you're potentially damaging someone. If that is completely untrue, I've lost a lot of respect for Dom Cruz. And, you know, and I think time is going to tell exactly how that happened. But yeah, when he mentioned about the cigarettes thing, I'm like, really? That's supposed to be some big deal? You know, also, like, if it was Henry Cejudo versus Marlon Moraes, and it was Moraes in there, not Cruz, does Cruz still call it a early stop at 100%? I'm positive of it.
No, I don't think so. And it kind of felt like the broadcasters were giving him a little leeway because he's part of the broadcasting family for the UFC as well. You know, Dom really had to go out there to get criticism from his compatriots. But it still was an early stoppage in a championship fight, is what I'll say. Especially because you had the hand clapping. And I almost wonder if for Keith Peterson, the hand clapping forced him to stop early because he thought, if I don't stop it now, this fight's going to go to this next round. And it's like, what if this dude's out? Like, I don't know. That's a weird thought that maybe struck his mind. But when you look again, when you look at the time he chose to stop the fight, Cruz went from like trying to get up to limp for a second. And then he got back up. You know, it's real easy to get back up when, you know, the fight's over. So I do think the stoppage is early, especially in a championship fight. There's a good chance Dominic Cruz never gets an opportunity to contend for a title again. But I will say one other thing that I disagree with is Dom Cruise told Keith Peterson before the fight that, like, you know, let me fight. Like, don't stop it early. Like, let me get beat up, essentially, was what he was saying. And I don't jive with that. I think every fight should be officiated equally, regardless of what the competitor wants the officiating to be.
I think that's putting the referee in a very tough position, because what if you let the thing go on too long and something tragic happens? I mean, I don't think any referee is going to do that. I mean, it's going to be interesting to kind of see what happens with Dom Cruise going forward, you know, and what happens with the bantamweight title and saying Henry Cejudo truly is going to retire. I'm sure the UFC is going to give him a week or two. Then they're going to pick up that phone and say, Henry, are you truly retired? Are you done? And then, A, also, does Henry exit the USADA drug testing pool? I think that's another key aspect of this. But, I mean, look, I'm not shocked that Henry Cejudo called a criminal. This is a guy that's been competing at a high level for 20 plus years. I'm actually going to be speaking to one of his coaches, Eddie Cha, later on today. So I'll kind of get Eddie's thoughts on that. But yeah, it's kind of tough to believe. But if we are talking about a vacant title, and Cejudo mentioned about doing a four-man tournament, Daniel, I'm all in on that. If you tell me we got a four-man tournament of Marlon Moraes, Aljamain Sterling, Peter Yan, and Corey Sandhagen, sign me up.
Yeah, I think this was the perfect division to have a vacant title. Like, there was already a line of multiple hardcore contenders because Cejudo was taking these types of fights against Cruz. And I think this division is due for a hell of a tournament. I think that would be a great way to go about crowning the champion. I think the UFC is in search for real marketable fights. You know, Felicia Spencer and Amanda Nunes is the next pay-per-view, and overall that card is still lacking real depth. I think you put together a bantamweight tournament among the top bantamweight contenders. That's certainly one way to draw people to purchase your pay-per-view. When you have names like Sandhagen or Jan, who maybe aren't known to your casual audience, but the sell of we are crowning a champion, this is a four-man tournament. That to me is perfect. Like, I would absolutely sign up for that.
Yeah, I mean, it'll be interesting to kind of see what happens there. You know, you speak about, you know, what's coming up in title fights. Got to look at that heavyweight division of, boy, good Lord. I thought maybe we potentially saw a death in the cage after Francis Ngannou. Well, I think he missed about three strikes, but then he lands that one strike that puts Jair Rosenstruck down for the mat. And, you know, it's interesting what's going on with the heavyweight title picture here, because you know, it's one of these things. I think overall in MMA, Daniel, we kind of, I think for the most part, we maybe don't look at both sides of the equation in terms of a story. And I tweeted about this last week of, you know, we're hearing what Dana White has to say about Stipe Miocic. We're also hearing what Stipe is having to say. And I feel like it's one of these things where we're hearing what makes both sides look the best. And the truth is somewhere in the middle. Like, what is going on behind the scenes? And I understand what Daniel Cormier is saying to Stipe Miocic. Look, you're saying you want to fight in the fall? Okay, just give me a date. The fall is, what, 4 months? That's a lot of dates. So I understand where Daniel Cormier is coming from, but also, like, In a way, I understand where Dana White is coming from as well. You know, and I think he's looking at this saying, okay, look, we got to know. I understand you're a first responder and obviously coming back from the eye injury that Stipe had. But I feel like what we're hearing from Daniel Cormier is kind of really where the middle part of all this is. I'm sure there's probably a financial part of it that Stipe and his manager are trying to get more money out of the UFC. I'm sure that's part of it. But also, I kind of side with Daniel Cormier and saying, look, you got to give me a date, bro.
You got to give him a date that he can work towards. I mean, it's tough because you really empathize for him. But there's two sides of the equation. And for Daniel Cormier, time is limited for this guy. So he's got to get a date, or now he's going to take another fight. And, God, it just to me, it's like, With the absence of Stipe, I'm like, let's just put the title around Francis Ngannou. He looks like a heavyweight champion. But for Daniel, it's like, dude, if you're Cormier, you want that Stipe fight. Because I want no business being in that cage competing for an interim title against Francis Ngannou.
Scary, bro. He's a scary dude. And
if you want to retire, that's the way to go. If you want to retire, that's the way to go. So I think the Stipe fight, he should probably wait for it.
Yeah, I mean, like, the thing is, like, if I'm in the UFC's position, and I don't see what the value is in doing an interim title fight of Ngannou and Cormier, unless Cormier is going to commit to doing two fights. If Cormier is only going to commit to one fight, which seems to be the plan, I just don't think Ngannou, Cormier for an interim title makes a lot of sense. But look, I understand where the frustration of Francis Ngannou is. He's probably sitting there going, okay, I went out there, and this was essentially a number one contenders fight, even though the UFC didn't call it that. I think that's what we can understand what this fight was. I'm sure he's sitting there going, okay, I've got this payday. When's my next payday coming? Because he doesn't know when Stipe is going to defend the title. You know, obviously, you know, Stipe has a job as a first responder, and obviously we know what's going on there. But I just feel like there's these situations in how this sport is covered where people don't really look at both sides of the conversation. They spin the narrative in the way they want to spin the narrative. And I sit there and look, there's things you can clearly be critical about what Dana White has said about this situation. But the one thing I will agree with Dana White on is where he mentioned about fighting is not going to be there forever. Folks, he's completely true. Fighting will not be there forever for Stipe Miocic. And that is something that Stipe has to think about. Fighters have best case scenario, 20 years. Okay. But you may only have 3 or 4 or 5 of those years to be a maximum earner in a position that Stipe is in. For Stipe to say fighting's always going to be there, I can't go along with those lines, Daniel.
Yeah, it's not always going to be there. And the thing for Stipe is he has been pretty difficult at times to deal with from the UFC end. And while you want to support the fighters, at some point it's like, well, we also want to see the fights. And it's, you know, it's not the Stipe Miocic world, so for Stipe, you really got to applaud him for what he's doing in his life. But overall, the fights go on. And again, fights will not be there. And you talk about a 20-year career. A small portion of that career is you on top of the world. There are a few exceptions. Again, if you are an all-time great, and especially in the heavyweight division, it's a bit easier to extend your prime. A lot of these guys are aged heavyweights. I mean, we saw a damn 42-year-old take on another 42-year-old on the card the other day. But for Stipe, a lot of what Dana is throwing down is correct. And, you know, there is a lot of pressure on the UFC to put on marketable fights. Again, the UFC 250 pay-per-view is not going to do well as presented. Obviously, there has to be a lot to be added, but Nunez Spencer is not making much money. And there just aren't a lot of fights like that. One of the most marketable things the UFC has is the heavyweight championship. To be the heavyweight champion in of itself is marketable. And Stipe is kind of holding that hostage, which are the reasons warranted potentially. But for the UFC, at some point you're gonna have to start looking at going another direction if he's just not gonna get in the cage and compete.
Yeah, I mean, and look, I think that if I'm in Dana White's position, I'm sitting there going, okay, I want to put on a heavyweight title fight probably. I mean, I'm sure he would love to put it on July or August. And, you know, I understand the frustration that he has and obviously, you know, the frustration Cormier has. But I also feel like Stipe is kind of giving Cormier exactly what happened to him a year ago when Cormier was, you know, seeking that Brock Lesnar fight. So we'll see what happens there. Of course, you know, on Friday, so Friday night, Daniel, I'm sitting here at the house, you know, throwing some darts and, you know, having some beers, and I get a text message going, are you on Twitter? And I'm like, here we go. And then of course the news of Jacare Souza, you know, testing positive for the coronavirus. Also, and then also we learned that, you know, there was, you know, family, history with this, you know, family member having the virus, and of course his teammates having this as well. And one of the questions we got here from Chris, he says, how worried should the UFC be about the corona cases last week? Chris, I would probably say I think their worry is exactly the same, but I think it's also the UFC is relying on medical officials to, you know, make sure that everything's being done in the proper way. I'm sure, obviously, I know Ariel Helwani had that tweet about how some of the protocols have changed for the fighters who are fighting tomorrow, meaning Wednesday, or on Saturday. I would say that the UFC's worriness about this is probably the same it was a week ago.
Yeah, I think the worriness is there. I think the UFC is doing a pretty solid job given the circumstances when you look at the testing. And, you know, they did get Jacare, and, you know, knock on wood and cross their fingers and no one else tests positive. There's a lot of individuals within one event. And I know you had Jacare in his corner testing positive. So I think the UFC is worried. I would say they don't get an A-plus for their execution, probably like a B. So they're still passing. But, I mean, there are just little things that kind of worry me. Like, little things where it's like, you know, obviously, you know, a fist bump from Joe Rogan in the post-fight interview. That's probably, you know, not going to create the next outbreak of the coronavirus. But it could, you know. Dana White fist bumping guys. Dana White not wearing a mask during the weigh-ins. All these little things don't necessarily mean things are going crazy. But the way my brain works with this situation is, if you can put yourself in a position to limit the risk, whether it be by the 0.01%, maybe you can do it. And so there are the little things you look at when you look at the presentation on Saturday night, where it's like they aren't doing everything they can. They're doing a lot of good things. It's not an A+. There is still room for improvement. We won't see that improvement because I think there's a real attitude change in what's going on. But the people behind the scenes are doing a great job from what I can obtain. It seems like they're really they're getting the test done. They're quarantining people, not complete isolation. The idea that Jacare was completely isolated, it was a bunch of malarkey when you see that. But it seems like a learning process. Again, this is a very difficult situation for everyone across the country. Probably wouldn't have wanted the fights to come back on so early, but I tell you what, I was real happy to see the fights. It provided me great joy, and at some point we are going to have to get back to normal. So overall, they're doing a solid job, just not like an A+ job, right? It's not complete and total precaution, but for the most part, I would say the U.S. is doing a good job, and I'm sure they have maintained the same level of worry.
This is, and I haven't, and I'm still kind of holding back on my general thoughts about this whole Jacare situation, because I want to hear Jacare's side of the story. You know, I think that what I saw on Friday night on Twitter, it's amazing how many doctors are on Twitter, by the way. I don't know if you've noticed this, yeah. Daniel. Oh, I didn't realize how many doctors love MMA. That was like my first thought. My second thought is like, let me hear Jacare's side of this before I just jump to a conclusion on a quote unquote hot take about the situation. I want to hear his side. And I think my most important question I would ask Jacare is that if you had a family member who tested positive for this and you were around them before leaving Orlando to go to Jacksonville, because he lives and trains in Orlando, why did you not inform the UFC of this? That would be my number one question.
Yeah, I think that would be my number one question too. It's a no-brainer. If you've been with someone who has coronavirus, you got to inform people like way prior, and either they pulled the fight right then and there, which is probably what they should do, or they test you. But really, they should just pull the fight. I mean, you can get tested and be negative and then be positive later. So like, you just pull the fight. It's okay. Like, Uriah Hall, Jacare Souza can fight another day, and it's just a weird thing to not explain to the UFC when it's such a prevailing conversation point to be safe and to make sure you haven't interacted with someone with COVID-19.
Well, I think because the easy thing is to immediately blast the UFC. I mean, and that's very easy to do. I understand that. But I'm also like, okay, I think there's questions you got to ask Jacare. And then once you hear Jacare's side of the story, then I feel that becomes a point where you can start to kind of have that conversation of, okay, and really try to figure out exactly what happened. I mean, and I whether we ever truly know what happens, I don't know. I don't know if we're ever going to find out. I mean, look, and I know you said this last week, it's probably going to be 3 to 4 weeks from now before whether we truly know the UFC did everything they possibly could to make sure that everyone was being put in a safe environment.
Yeah, they did do a good job from what I could see from the outside looking in. And so I'll applaud them there. You know, I do think for a lot of people, they're looking at each and every instance to poke and prod at the UFC and frame them in a negative way. And I'm not here to, you know, drink their bathwater, but I think the overall operation was something that a lot of sporting leagues can look at and be like, this is what we can do next. But the one deal with this situation and just the situation in general, people opening up, is a lot of what we know now can change dramatically in 2 weeks. You know, the results of our actions today are usually not things we know for a couple of weeks. You know, it would be a rough thing for us to come out here and applaud them wholeheartedly, and 2 weeks later we find out half the people there haven't. That's possible in this crazy reality. Unlikely, but certainly possible. So I think an important thing to have with this situation is not having the mentality of like, we nailed this, because we don't necessarily know if we nailed this. This is a very unique situation. I am no scientist, but by God, this damn thing shut down the whole world. So you know it's pretty damn significant, and you know it spreads like crazy. So who knows? I'm optimistic. I'm glad the UFC is putting events back on, and I do think they're doing a solid job given the resources. They obtained a whole lot of tests. Everyone got tested. That's a positive. So yeah, I'm looking forward to move forward. But one thing to keep in mind is this is always a very, very fluid situation, and things do change by the week.
Fluid situation is a great way to discuss that. One other thing I want to mention related to UFC 249 is, you know, it came out, actually it was a tweet by Steven Espinoza. Then there was an article by Kevin Ioli, and Dana White talked about the post-fight press conference. Now there's a story on Bloody Elbow about this waiver. I don't know why people are shocked the UFC would want people to sign this. I think there can be criticism of it, but I don't think anyone should be shocked the UFC's legal department went this route.
Yeah, it's, you know, I'm sure the UFC pays the legal department quite a bit of money, and they do it to cover your ass, is what the UFC does. And this was an interesting little story. They went out there, and I think overall, I think it was probably blown out of proportion a bit.
Well, I mean, this is the thing that sticks out to me is, A, would this thing hold up in court? And, you know, based on some of the things I've read, it sounds like it would not, especially when you're talking about you're signing off for other people in your immediate family. You know, there's the media aspect of this. And I retweeted the comment that John Morgan made I can't think of the podcast off the top of my head. Submission or guy, I can't whatever the podcast is called out of Australia. The guys do a great job. It's an unbelievable podcast. But you know, it would be one of those things that if I was going to cover that event, and if I worked for an outlet like MMA Junkie or any other outlet, I guess my first question would be calling my bosses about it and saying, hey, this is what I'm hearing. And also I would probably send that agreement to my lawyer and say, hey, can you read over this thing and see what I'm actually agreeing to here? It's an interesting thing to see how it is. But one of the things I will say is I think that if you were going to cover this event as a media member, you knew the risk you're taking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I think there's certainly a risk being there. And the thing is, like, You probably still would want your own lawyer to look at it, right? Like, like if you have someone who gives you something to sign and they're explaining to you what's in there, you don't want to trust them all the way. Like, you don't know. Like, you know, I'm sure, like, it's like they're giving you the best interpretation from their own perspective. They are not an independent voice here. So you probably want your own thing, and you don't more foresight, you know. That is a problem. But yeah, if you're going there, you are taking a risk, and it's a very interesting situation there with the media members. But yeah, I think you know, overall though, it was something where I felt like people were just looking for that smoking gun, and maybe this wasn't what they were looking for. But immediately, you know, Twitter was on fire that you know, the UFC was controlling the media.
I mean, look, the whole waiver thing, I'm not surprised by it, and I really think that if you follow the sport, this shouldn't really be a surprising thing. You also should note that during the pay-per-view, did announce that George St. Pierre is going to the Hall of Fame. And, you know, obviously there's so many things, Daniel, we can talk about George St. Pierre, but when I think of my memories of GSP, they all involve him fighting in Canada and just what that environment was like. A guy who had a complete country behind him.
Yeah, it was, It was crazy watching the energy in that package. It was really a different time. I mean, you watch him in the cage post fight. If you started a UFC Hall of Fame today, he would be in the first ballot. He was possibly the greatest fighter of all time, and he's a worthy induction. It kind of felt like, damn, really? About time. But yeah, it was an impeccable thing, and yeah, the whole country of Canada rallied behind George St. Pierre. He's one of the biggest stars in the history of the sport, probably the most talented, successful career we have seen thus far that has not been affected by drug violations, and it's obviously a deserving member of the Hall of Fame. He deserves his own wing in the Hall of Fame. He's part of that elite tier of Hall of Famers.
Yeah, I mean, it was kind of one of those things in a way. You're like, wow, GSP's not in the Hall of Fame yet? I mean, that was kind of one of those things. But yeah, absolutely, if not the greatest MMA fighter of all time, he's definitely in that top three consideration. But when we talk about great fighters, Dan, over the past couple of weeks, we have been going down our top 100 active fighter countdowns. Last week, we went 51 through 60. This week, we're going to go through 41 through 50. And Daniel, there's a lot of names on here of fighters that I just love to watch fight. You know, starting off with number 50, we've got Dan Hooker, number 49, Curtis Blaydes, 48, Darren Till, 47, Nate Diaz, 46, Stephen Thompson, 45, Bran Moreno, 44, Charles Oliveira, 43, Rose Namajunas, 42, Zabit Magomedsharipov, and number 41, Jessica Andrade. I'll start right at number 50. Dan Hooker, to me, is one of these guys that, you know, he is going, you know, he is on that upward trajectory to where he is a fight or two away from being in line for a title shot.
Yeah, he has just been unbelievable. Just an unbelievable run these past couple of years where it was a great performance against a top contender bout against Paul Felder. I mean, he really elevated himself prior to that with his win over Aoi Quinta. And he has a series of high-level striking victories. So, you know, you're looking at his last eight fights, his lone loss was a TKO loss to Edson Barboza. Moving forward, Dan Hooker is just an excellent, excellent striker. And you start to get excited about what he would look like against some of the best of the division. I mean, the idea of him competing against Justin Gaethje, for instance, that's a hell of a contest. Sign me up for Hooker versus Gaethje. Sign me up for Hooker versus Ferguson. I mean, when you get to the top 50, each guy or gal on this list is a fight or two away from competing for a championship. And Dan Hooker is definitely one of those people.
Yeah, I mean, 49 Curtis Blaydes, obviously one of the top heavyweights. He did find himself in the headlines. Obviously not liking the fact of female fighters using their attractiveness to increase their awareness and their brand marketability. But Curtis Blaydes is definitely up there. I mean, obviously he's got the wrestling pedigree, but obviously, you know, he's fought now Francis Ngannou twice, has not get past him. Darren Till now at 185 pounds. It's kind of interesting to kind of see how he can progress there. Of course, Nate Diaz, who knows the next time we'll see him. Stephen Thompson, the other one that in this list that I two fighters that I will particularly point out, we'll see if you got any other ones you really want to discuss, would be Charles Oliveira and Zabit Magomedsharipov. These are two guys that you tell me they're fighting, I want to see. Obviously, the big question I have on Zabit is simply this: if it's a 5-round fight, what does Zabit Magomedsharipov look like? Because if him versus Calvin Kattar was a 5-round fight, I don't think he wins that fight.
Yeah, I mean, there's a reason his camp made sure that fight was 3 rounds, and we saw it when they fought each other. The tide was changing as that fight was going on, and it was a hell of a fight. And Zabit definitely has to work on that conditioning, and he's fighting himself in a point where his next UFC fights are going to be 5-round fights. He's going to be in main events. He may be in a championship fight. Thus far, he's aced every test in the UFC, and he has great potential, but for your cardio to be an issue, that's something that he can definitely fix. I mean, he's great. I think the name on this list that's interesting to me would probably be 43, Rose Namajunas. I mean, she is a fighter who, when things are on, she fights like the best fighter on the planet. But she's had a couple tough losses, a split decision to Kovalkiewicz, and most recently that loss to Jessica Andrade. This is a fighter who's only fought 12 times, but very quickly she's established herself as one of the most raw, talented fighters. Literally, you know, all but three of her fights have been in the UFC. And for her, she's obviously, I know she lost two family members to COVID-19, so all the best wishes to her. But I look forward to seeing her compete again, because this is a fighter who really showcases an ability to just always be in the championship picture. And this, again, is a fighter who is still just 27 years old.
Yeah, I think the question, you know, is with her, because of obviously her personal experience with this virus, at what point does she fight again? I think that's a, you know, and I think every fighter is having that discussion with themselves and team of do you feel comfortable putting yourself in that scenario? I mean, look at Greg Hardy, how much he talked about and how much he was concerned about, you know, because of obviously having asthma and how much that, you know, that's obviously a factor in obtaining this virus. So, you know, it's, you know, Charles, you know, Bram Moreno is a guy that, God, who knows what's going to go on at 125 pounds, Daniel, but he's a guy that's going to be right there for a title shot. And I mean, look, we were supposed, you know, you mentioned about Namajunas. We were supposed to see her rematch against Jessica Andrade. How different would that fight look if they would have fought at UFC 249? I mean, we saw the first fight, which ultimately all got changed by a slam. But I mean, if you go back and you watch that fight, the first round, Rose Namajunas was having a lot of success. So, you know, we're getting to this point in the countdown where we're seeing a lot of fires like, oh, that's a fire that can be in championship mode. So we'll continue our countdown next week here on the podcast as we will go 40 through 31. But Daniel, we've got two fight cards coming up this week. Tomorrow we've got UFC Fight Night, Smith versus Teixeira, and then on Saturday night we've got UFC Fight Night, Overeem versus Walt Harris. Well, I mean, look, we absolutely love the fight card for UFC 249. You know, these are fight night cards. I mean, you know, you've got a couple fights on each card that really stick out to you. I mean, when I look at Wednesday's card, there's two fights that really stick out to me, and then there's a couple other fighters that I'm intrigued by. You know, my top two fights, to me, it's a clear 1-2. Number one being Anthony Smith versus Glover Teixeira. Number two being Alexander Hernandez versus Drew Dober. You know, some of the fighters that I'm interested to kind of see how their fights go, I would look at Marvin Vettori, who's taking on Carl Roberson. Roberson did miss weight earlier today, missed weight by a pound and a half. The fight is still on. You know, Roberson will be fined 20% of his purse. You know, other fights that, you know, stick out to me, I'm interested to see Ike Villanueva make his UFC debut against Chase Sherman. I feel pretty confident saying someone's getting knocked out in that fight. Hunter Azure, a guy that I've talked to, you know, several times, is interested to see what he looks like. Ricky Simon will be the other one, but it just in terms of fight quality, the two fights that, I gotta watch is Anthony Smith versus Glover Teixeira and Alexander Hernandez versus Drew Dober. Now, main card starts at 9 p.m. Eastern time, Daniel. Wednesday night's my guilty pleasure night, the challenge on MTV. I'm sitting there at 8 o'clock watching every week. So, fights will be on the iPad.
Wow, that's it. Damn, I didn't know you're a big fan of the challenge.
Oh, dude, I have been watching since it was Real World Road Rules Challenge. This is guilty pleasure of mine. Yes. It's funny. Last week, somehow it comes up on my Twitter timeline, you know, talk with somebody about it. And like, three or four people start responding. I'm like, I've gotten more responses today about the challenge than I have on anything MMA related.
I know that's a crazy community that you got going on. I mean, I got my own wrestling going on. We have AEW Dynamite and whatnot. The Wednesday night is an interesting one. It's like, no UFC, and we're just going to force it down your throat. You know, and I'll be watching. I'm excited for it. You know, thankfully, don't have to spend $64.99 for this card. That would be a tough one to spend on. But I'm excited. It's not that good of a card, for sure. It's a lot of fights that are very flat. Just because you just have a lot of guys who are just trying to maintain some momentum, work their way up the ranks, and that in and of itself isn't particularly exciting, but it's real easy to talk yourself into the lightweight contest between Alexander Hernandez and Drew Dober. I mean, that's the odds-on favorite to be fight of the night, and that's just a phenomenal fight. The main event is okay, too. It's a contest between two top light heavyweight contenders. Between Smith and Teixeira, these are two guys who we've seen before. I think Anthony Smith probably has a lot more left in the tank than Glover, but Glover's been solid in his most recent run here. So I think for in this fight, I mean, I would expect Smith to win. And I think the best fight on this fight card is Hernandez Dober. And then after that, it is a pretty big drop-off. But, yeah, I mean, you still have your familiar names. You still have Andre Arlovski competing. Michael Johnson's taking on Tiago Moises. Sajara Eubanks is a name to watch in the women's bantamweight division where she could certainly build her way up to a title shot eventually. And then if I'm giving you the number three fight I'm looking forward to, it would be Ricky Simon versus Ray Borg. So that's my number three fight. And I'm also kind of excited about the co-main event, which is not a great co-main event, but OSP is moving up to the heavyweight division against Ben Rothwell.
You know, that's a fight, and I was talking about this on the DFS show I did last night, where, you know, more times than not, we see where OSP kind of ends up putting his back up against the fence, to where I feel that Ben Rothwell might actually be able to use that to his advantage, to where he may use that weight advantage and really make this a clinch fest type fight there. You know, in the main event, to me, this is, if Glover is ever going to make another run at the UFC title, he's got to win tomorrow night. If he does not win this fight, I think that that ultimately ends his quest for a UFC light heavyweight title fight. I mean, he has quietly put on together a three-fight winning streak, but I do expect Anthony Smith. I was actually surprised because I just had the betting odds up here. To me, it is surprising to see Alexander Hernandez as a slight underdog against Drew Dober. To me, I think that Alex Hernandez should be the favorite in that one. In terms of betting underdogs, I think you've got to look at as potential fighters who can win. I would look at Ike Villanueva, who, as we do this show, is plus 140. On Five Dimes. You know, maybe Gabriel Benitez at plus 155. Outside of that, there's not really an underdog that really sticks out to me. Maybe, I mean, you know, maybe you could look at Ray Borg, but my concern with Ray Borg is I think he's ultimately a fighter who I believe is stuck in between two weight classes. I think if there was a 130-pound weight class, that would probably be the ideal weight for Ray Borg, but we've seen the issues with him getting the 125. And now he's at 135. I think he's just going to look so undersized.
Yeah, I think so too. But I mean, he just has an inability to make 125. So, you know, that's the punishment you get there. But I think for him, giving up the size, he's got to hope he maintains some more energy here and he's able to utilize the advantage of an easier weight cut. And, you know, he's already had enough trouble doing weight cuts as is. It would probably be much harder with the quarantine, but the size is going to be huge because he's definitely a guy who just does not stick out as a big flyweight. So as a bantamweight, it's going to be a rough one for Borg, but he could certainly still get the victory here.
And then, of course, on Saturday, it's UFC Fight Night, Overeem versus Harris. By the way, both of these fight cards, prelims start 6 p.m. Eastern time, 3 p.m. out on the West Coast. And the main card starting at 9 p.m. Eastern time, 6 p.m. Pacific time. I believe they are both on ESPN. I know they're definitely both on ESPN Plus, but I believe, let me double check this here. Don't want to give out any false information. I'm pretty sure I know Saturday's event is on ESPN, and looking on the UFC website as it loads up here, tonight, Wednesday's card will be on ESPN Plus, both the main card and prelims, but I am pretty sure that Saturday's main card for Harris and Overeem is on ESPN. Just want to double check that so we're not giving away, and that is correct. It is on ESPN and ESPN Plus on Saturday as well. You know, you got Overeem versus Walt Harris. Of course, this will be Walt's first fight since the tragic situation that happened with his family. They're actually going to be doing a piece on him that was done by Tom Rinaldi on Friday. Will debut on the 12 p.m. Eastern time edition of SportsCenter. I would probably say I like the Saturday card more than I like the Wednesday card, but also kind of same situation. There's a couple of fights that stick out to me. I'll let you go first on this one, Daniel. What's the one fight that ultimately draws you to the fight card?
It's got to be Ige and Barboza, you know, in the featherweight division. I mean, that's just, on one side, you have a guy who has a lot of momentum. On the other side, you have Barboza, who's looking to reclaim that momentum. Both guys are very exciting. Barboza especially, and this featherweight contest is the top fight. You can't go wrong with the heavyweight contest either. You know, the small teaser they showed of Walt Harris was very, very interesting. Very, very good. You know, I think if you're a casual fan or whatnot watching that, you get drawn to the television set and you start to ask, when's he going to fight? This is a crazy story that went national. And the fact that it touched someone who's a UFC fighter is an unbelievable story. And you feel so bad for Walt Harris and his family. But he, in 2019, had the best year of his career with a combination of quick first round, first minute victories over Alexei Oleinik and Sergey Spivak. I mean, doing his best Francis Ngannou impersonation. By the way, we didn't talk too much about it, but Francis's performance was just one of, like, an unbelievable performance. And Walt Harris, Alistair Overeem, I mean, these are two heavy hitters. So I'm looking forward to that heavyweight contest.
Yeah, I'm with you. To me, the number one fight for me, it definitely is Danny Ige versus Edson Barboza. But yeah, you know, it's really in that main event of, you know, I don't know what Overeem is at this point in his career. I mean, clearly he's still a top 10 heavyweight in the UFC. But, you know, Walt Harris has put together a nice little streaker. You mentioned about what he was able to do in 2019. You know, I think in terms of the five fights that are on the main card, I like all of them. I really like the Song Yadong Marlon Vera matchup. Anders Jocko is a good fight. Gedalia versus Hill, which, you know, it kind of seems like a fight that you would think that Claudia is just going to take down Angela Hill. These are the type of fights that Angela Hill does tend to struggle in. I mean, she's able to have success when she's able to keep the fight on the feet, but you got to imagine that Claudia is going to look to go to the ground. You know, in terms of the preliminary card, probably the fight that I probably interests me the most, I guess, would be Darren Elkins versus Nate Landwehr.
Yeah, I think so. The other one that sticks out to me is Matt Brown, Michael Baeza. Just that Matt Brown is just like, damn, he's a bad hombre, and his fights are usually balls to the walls. But Elkins and Landwehr means a lot more in the context of the featherweight division, whereas you could see one of those guys making a solid run at it, whereas the Brown fight, I mean, Brown's at the tail end of his career. So overall, the prelims are a pretty big drop-off, but the main card is pretty solid.
I mean, we're at the point with Matt Brown's career where he's just going to be taking on rising prospects.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, that's the role for him. He's going to have exciting fights. I mean, he's 39 years old. He's already gone his career run back in the early part of the last decade. And now it's just putting him in there and getting as many fights in a row. But, man, if he beats Baeza, look, he's beat three guys in a row there. I mean, his last performances, he had a knockout win over Sanchez, a win over Saunders. I mean, we've seen crazier things in a late career run for Matt Brown as he enters, you know, his 40 years of living on this planet.
Dude, Miguel Baeza is a 2-1 betting favorite in that fight. I mean, I would definitely say you got to think Matt Brown is a little bit of a live dog in that one. Just in terms of some of the underdogs on that fight card, Alistair Overeem at +140. I think you can never count out the Ream. I think another underdog that I would look at, Dan Ige, who's at +110. Who's the other underdog I saw? Marlon Vera at +160. I think there's some underdogs, but I would say overall, if you say I have to either watch Wednesday's card or Saturday's card, I'm picking Saturday's card.
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, you know, I think the best fight of the entire week has to be Barboza Ige. I think the card on Saturday has several fights that I'm interested in, whereas the one on Wednesday only has two. And UFC on ESPN 8 is just a superior card to UFC on ESPN Plus 29, which is kind of crazy that they're at 29 already. But yeah, I think, look, I'm excited for fights. Things are kind of getting back to normal. UFC on ESPN 8 will be interesting. And man, it's just we'll see what happens on the next fight night the following week. I mean, these cards they aren't looking too good right now. I mean, it's hard to get the factory going of putting on these fight nights after a while, especially because you do have several fighters who maybe aren't prepared to fight yet.
Well, I think also it comes along the lines of if you're in a situation currently where pretty much a majority of your card are going to be Americans or fighters who are already in the United States, I think that you kind of wonder how much that talent pool is going to ultimately dry out for the UFC in terms of what fighters can get ready. I mean, you know, Fight Island, you know, Dana White mentioned, you know, middle of June is kind of what he's hoping for there. You know, that first Fight Island show is going to be really interesting to kind of see how that does play out and the type of fights that we're going to get. I mean, obviously, you know, I think as more and more states open up, I think that's going to open up some potentials for the UFC. Dana White in the post-fight press conference, he mentioned that there was about 10 locations within the United States that they knew they could go to. And it's going to be interesting to see. You know, one news item that I definitely want to mention here, Kelvin Gastelum, news came out that, you know, he tested positive for above the threshold for marijuana for his fight there at UFC 244. And obviously that always becomes a conversation about why are we testing for marijuana? But I'm like, the limit is 150 milligrams per milliliter. And then USADA adds 20% to that number, which means Kelvin Gastelum tested above 180 milligrams per milliliter, which I know based in the conversations I've had with people in this industry before about this, at 150, it's basically you have to ingest within 72 hours of taking that test, which in a way I think becomes an IQ test. But, you know, it's, you know, it makes you wonder about how Kelvin could test that high when you know the drug test is coming.
Yeah. Yeah. Big time IQ test. I mean, it's still perplexing to see guys get punished for that, though, even though their threshold is higher. But the threshold is so high that it is an IQ test, even though it's like I just would eliminate this type of test in general.
I think the only – would there be a test that you could prove that someone partaked in cannabis within 8 hours of the drug test?
I have no idea. I have no idea.
Like, look, you know, I don't think you want someone going in high into a fight.
I don't think they would want to go in high either.
But I think it's one of those things of, could we get to a point where they could really pinpoint when the last time you took part?
Yeah, I mean, that would be interesting because that would probably be the one thing you do want to prevent is guys fighting high. But otherwise, I just don't see the need for it. But
here's the question. If we drug test for marijuana, why don't we drug test for alcohol?
That's true. Fighting drunk. I mean, I think it'll be pretty obvious. Maybe we'll just have Dom Cruz out there and he'll let us know who's high and who's drunk. Because apparently he's so damn good at figuring that out.
Like, I would imagine that if a commission thought someone was drunk, I don't think they're letting them go out there. But it is a... It's an interesting question to ask. And of course, after this news came out on Monday about it, that was, you know, I saw a couple people, you know, kind of tweeting about it, but it's also one of these things of, you know, you know, the drug test is coming. This isn't a situation of years ago where you may get tested on fight night. You may not. And, you know, and I think the important part of this is, look, marijuana is only on the banned list in competition. So you can sit there and, you know, smoke and have as many gummies as you want throughout your fight camp. But you gotta know there becomes a point where you have to stop. I mean, and look, and this is the thing, if, you know, a lot of fighters are using marijuana and, you know, CBD as a way to, it's part of their recovery. And look, and I can tell you this, in terms of CBD, I am a huge believer in CBD. Like this morning, my back was goddamn killing me. Put that rub on cream and by you know, a couple hours, my back's feeling great. I mean, I'm a huge believer of CBD.
Yeah, I think that's the type of therapy that is probably superior to a lot of things, especially like painkillers or whatnot. And I mean, we're seeing a much more understanding of the use of these products. And again, I just think these types of testing are antiquated just because you look at the direction society is going. I think it's therapy more so than recreational use. And, you know, it's fun to partake in the marijuana, but it's just not something that should be in the sport in terms of consequences for guys.
Look, as someone who has dealt with back pain for the last 10, 15 years, it'll flare about once or twice a year. Look, I've used the Icy Hots. I've used the rub-on Icy Hots. I've done the patches. I'm telling you, the best thing I ever did was get this CBD roll-on cream, you know, gel thing. Oh, my God. I'm telling you, if our listeners have a bad back, dude, and you haven't tried the CBD, you got to do it. I'm telling you, best thing by far. And you don't have that icy hot smell on you.
Yeah, that's the worst. That stink, that Bengay stink or the icy hot, that is awful. So that's a nice, yeah, and I think so many people relate to that. So many people do have pain and whatnot, so that type of therapy would be perfect.
Dude, there's nothing worse than icy hot smell. Because like once you put that on, then all of a sudden it gets on your bed sheets. You're like, oh man, I gotta change out. I gotta wash these sheets because it's that smell, man. It is oof. It's a bad thing. But yeah, like any of our listeners, man, if you got back pain, my seal approval goes on that. It's something I use all the time. But Daniel, that's going to wrap it up for this week's edition of the show, man. Great talking to you. Got a haircut today, so I'm feeling really good. But my big takeaway from getting a haircut today is people read headlines, not stories.
Yeah, well, that's society in general. But what happened with the headlines and the haircut situation?
Well, it was announced on Friday that starting on Monday that, barbers and hair salons are going to be able to be open. But if you read the article, it noted that it was by appointment only, by state, by the order of the governor. So I get the appointment set up on Saturday, walk in there this morning, and there must have been 10 people that walked in, and every one of the barbers like, dude, you got to have an appointment, man. That's the way this works. And it's just like, it was one of those things I was sitting there going, man, like it was one of those just like moments where you sit there and say, man, all as a society, for the most part, all we do is read tweets and headlines.
Yeah, that is absolutely true. That is absolutely true. And people tend to think the world just kind of revolves around them. But like, obviously you're going to need an appointment. I mean, like, in addition to the regulation and whatnot, you gotta think there's a pretty high demand for haircuts after all of us, grew out our hair the past few months. So I'm glad you got your haircut, man. I think I'm just gonna keep on growing mine until it gets too unbearable. I kind of like the way it goes. I got a hardcore mullet going on.
Dude, it was getting bad for me. Like, I'm trying to like trim up around the ears, and I was getting at a point of like, man, we just got to open up the barber shop, open up, and thankfully it opened up. I was feeling shaggy. I mean, like, man, I'm gonna have to wear a hat like every day now, just because his hair is just getting out of control. But yeah, man, felt good. You know, it's one of those things you walk out like, all right, I feel good now. I feel like I lost a couple of pounds here, and yeah, I mean, it's one of those things. Like, as a barber shop, like I feel like they should be auctioning off seats. Who wants the next haircut? We're starting the bid at $20.
That's a smart way to get the money back that they lost over the time, because there is a high demand. I mean, I know that was one of those things where we all realized how much we need our haircuts whenever we did not have the option to go get one. I think everyone was like, damn, I feel so grateful to have a barber.
It was funny because, there's four of the barbers there, two of them are females, and one of them said, goes, I did not realize before this how much you guys want your hair cut all the time.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, it was just something we took for granted. It's just, yeah, now it just became a necessity to look halfway decent. We realized how fast our damn hair grows.
I know. It's one of these things that this whole pandemic, it's made us realize what we do take for granted. I take for granted the ability to go get my car washed and get the inside washed. I was able to, go through just the regular car wash, but can't get the inside of my car detailed. And and every time, like, I feel like you go to the grocery store, people are looking at you weird if you don't have a mask on, which is weird here in Florida. There's actually a state statute that says you can't wear a mask in public. Now, it's an old it's an old statute related to the KKK, but I was sitting there. We were with my mom's on Sunday, and me, my brother, my mom, dad are kind of talking about it. And I said, I was like, look, if you're in the grocery store, how many coughs do you give somebody?
One. Is how it's going right now in society. One cough and
dude, I feel like when I'm in public, if I have to itch my face, I feel like I got to make sure no one's around. Because then I feel like if you itch your face, someone's going to look at you weird.
It's like you itch your face, you cough, you sneeze, you'll immediately become enemy number one, even though that's something that we all do normally. It just happens. But then you just become way more aware of the fact that you're coughing or somebody else's.
Look, here's the one thing I truly can't wait for. I can't wait for a Friday night to be able to go out with the boys, have some beers, and just, you know, shoot the breeze.
Yeah.
I almost said another word there. I try not to cuss on this show. I almost said another word.
yeah. That is something that is just, especially because it usually revolves around a sporting event, you know, whether you're watching a football game or a March Madness. And again, like this time really allowed us to reflect on what's happening.
That was the thing about Saturday night. It made me feel like it was a normal Saturday. You know, I think I talked about this last week. Like for me during the week, it's very normal for me just because of, you know, business hasn't changed much for me. And now that restaurants are open with what I do with the restaurant group that I work for, you know, obviously there's more work that's now associated with that. But the weekends has always been for me of like, what the hell do I do? How many games of Madden can I play? How many games of 2K can I play? But sitting on the couch Saturday night, like, I was genuinely excited all day long, even though I was waiting for the tweet to say the car was canceled.
Yeah, me too. I mean, especially when the Jacare news happened, it seemed, damn, this is inevitable. My
first thought was, thank God I haven't bought the pay-per-view yet.
I know, that was my thought too. I mean, we kind of talked about it, we joked about it, but it's a very real thing that during this time, do not buy a pay-per-view before the card kicks off.
Dude, by the way, ESPN gets me on those taxes, by the way.
I know. It goes from like $64 to like $72 somehow.
Yeah, I remember it last time. And I was like, but then I was paying attention when I was ordering it the other day on Saturday. And it was like $64.99 plus, you know, applicable taxes, whatnot. I'm pulling it up right now. I want to say it was like $74.13 is what the ultimate cost is for me after taxes.
Jesus.
Which Christ, I want to see the breakdown of that though. Mm-hmm. Like how is it $10 in taxes and surcharges?
I know. How do we have like a, you know,
ESPN they don't send you that detailed bill that says that. But then you think about it, so if everyone's getting charged $74-ish, mm-hmm. times out by 700,000 buys, ooh, that's a lot of money.
Yeah, they made a lot of money back in one night.
People got their stimulus money, baby.
They got the stimulus money. They spent a little bit on the old fights.
Yeah, man. It's the next pay-per-view will be June 6th. So we're still a couple ways from that. Of course, got UFC coming up on Wednesday and Saturday. Definitely be watching both of those fight cards. And then, of course, May 23rd, another UFC event. It sounds like it will not be in Jacksonville. So UFC going somewhere else. We'll see where that may be. Maybe, who knows? Maybe it's going to be in Las Vegas, as obviously, you know, that's where clearly Dana White would like these events to be, which makes a lot of sense since they have the UFC Apex. So, of course, if you ever have any questions or comments for the show, the best way to do that is just send us a tweet. I am at Jason_Floyd. Daniel is at Daniel Galvan. DGG. You can also leave a comment on this show, whether it's on theamereport.com or on radioinfluence.com. Of course, be sure also to give us those 5-star reviews. I really love those when you do that. Does help this show grow tremendously. So as always, appreciate everyone who checks out this podcast each and every week. So that's going to wrap it up for this week's edition of the MMA Report podcast, which, well, typically comes out on Wednesdays, but when we have a fight card on Wednesday, it's going to come out on Tuesday. So this has been the MMA Report podcast on radioinfluence.com.
This is an MJ Morning Show podcast quick fix on Radio Influence.
Guys, you know what really affected me this week? Did you hear that Sweet Tomatoes on Dale Mabry's closing?
You were the first person I thought of when I saw that. Every one of them closing. Every one, right?
Coronavirus thing must have really did them in. And you know what's a huge concern? After this is over, how long is it going to take for like buffets or restaurants that have buffets or big salad bars? How long is it going to take for them to get back in business? You know, I could see where you can survive because you have the sneeze guards, and maybe you'd have to give everybody their own tong and their own big spoon to use.
That's worse.
Why is
that's
that
even worse?
Why is that worse?
What if you lick the spoon? I mean,
you don't lick the spoon. So when you get your tray and your plate, you also have to get your own tongs and your own big spoon, and then you turn it in, let's say, at the cashier. Okay. And then if you go back, you got to get a brand new one. So I could see a way to survive, but man, this is so awful. We went to Sweet Tomatoes all the time on Dale Mabry. I don't know what my buddy Jeffrey's going to do. Jeffrey's been working at Sweet Tomatoes for like 30 years.
What about Ruby Tuesday? Is her salad bar going to go? Like, is this the end of Chinese buffets and salad bars?
I don't know.
Fester's about to break down and cry. Look at
Fester, you okay?
I really never thought of it like this. My wife and I were talking about, hey, this would be a really great time to book a trip to Vegas. And I was like, yeah, it would be, because everything's like dirt cheap right now. And then I'm like, wait, all the buffets are closed. And she's like, so? And I'm like, what the F do you mean, so? It's the best reason to go to Vegas is the buffets. What about the Golden Corral? It's one of my favorite places. Oh. The chocolate fountain, the fried shrimp, forget it.
That's now the Corona fountain.
No, Froggy, it's not limited to fruit.
And I'm sure there's some penis joke coming here.
No, I was thinking fried shrimp, you perv.
Oh, okay. All right.
The MJ Morning Show podcast can be found on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Google Podcasts, the iHeartRadio app, MJMorningShow.com, and RadioInfluence.com.